Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Backyard Labrish. I apologize for us being late this evening. I just had a couple of technical problems, but I see I have my co-host on, so I'm going to open up the mic to her and welcome her to this segment of Backyard Labrish. And hello, Donna, are you there? Hello? I guess she's not quite live yet. Anyway, I want to apologize to my listeners on Blog Talk Radio Backyard Labrish. Good evening and welcome. And I apologize for the delay in our transmission this evening. The senior had a definite senior moment, so please forgive me. And for those listening to the show later on, you will know that we started a little late, but we are here this evening to celebrate St. James because we are doing our Discover Jamaica one parish at a time. And this week we are in our 11th parish. We've been just touring the island and having a wonderful time discovering all the neat little information about all the different parishes. They're so special, and each one of them have something intriguing and interesting, and we always feel that we're in a moment of discovery as we find something that, of course, I didn't know before. And I want to welcome my co-host. I see where she's on, and the mic is open. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hi, Donna. How are you today?
Oh, good, good, good. I'm looking forward to the information enlightenment on St. James, and I'm definitely interested in more about the White House Witch of Rose Hall.
Ooh, that one is a juicy one. But again, I want to welcome our listeners to Backyard Labrish. We're here each week on a Wednesday at 8 o'clock. This evening we had some technical difficulties, so we're sort of getting started late, but I hope you'll forgive us. And I always tell my listeners, you know, as a lot of our regulars know, that you're talking to a senior's senior. So this evening I happen to have a senior moment and could not get into the platform that I was supposed to be broadcasting from. So do forgive me, and again, welcome to the show. So let's get started. So how are you today, Donna?
Oh,
are
I'm
you
doing
there?
Great. I'm doing great. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing great. I really am. And you?
I'm doing wonderful now that I'm on the air. You know, it always sort of turns me on when I'm broadcasting, because I am so thrilled to have the time and to have the interest in doing all this research about Jamaica, because it seems that I took so much for granted when I was growing up there. I mean, it was just a place that I grew up in, and I really don't think that I appreciated all the special things about it. And, you know, sorry, we had a little mishap. But as we grow older, I think, and we look back, Donna, we really realize how fortunate we are. You know, we look back at the things that we took for granted and realize, you know, that we really need to celebrate them. Because in the times we're living in, the more things we find to be, to feel good about, I think is the more it's going to help us through this difficult period that the world is experiencing. So I want to welcome all our visitors and our listeners, both online at the moment and those who might listen to the show later on. And I want to tell you that we have been celebrating each parish as we go through on our island tour, and we have covered a big portion of the island. As a matter of fact, Donna, we only have four to go, and then we'll complete the whole country. Isn't that interesting? Yes.
Wow.
You know, we're a little spot on the map, but we have a saying in our dialect that we little but with talawa. And I don't know where the word talawa came from, but in what we mean is that we are huge. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Even though we're just a little dot on the map compared to your country or my country now that has been become my home. So this week we're going to talk about the parish of St. James, whose capital is Montego Bay. And Donna, I'm sure that almost most Americans that travel have heard of Montego Bay. I'm sure you have, haven't you?
Yeah, I've heard of Montego Bay. Everybody talks about that.
That's right. But one of the reasons that is because it has a major airport, and it's really the north coast of the country. If you look on the map, you see it's extremely north. Now, we have another major airport in Kingston, but although Kingston has its share of tourism, it doesn't compare, actually, to Montego Bay. And if you remember, as we did some parishes, as a matter of fact, I think we mentioned that Portland, which was actually the first place, you know, way back in the days from the Spaniards had it and the British had it, that was really the first place that attracted tourists. However, Montego Bay, even if someone is going to that side of the island now, they would have to land in Montego Bay or Kingston. So Montego Bay, because it has a major airport there, of course, I think is the largest parish in terms of tourism. So actually, it's also a very special place because it's the birthplace of one of Jamaica's. We only have seven national heroes in Jamaica, and one of the heroes happened to be born in that particular parish. So that we're going to talk a little bit about today. But what I thought was very interesting, Donna, is the fact that it was considered one of the poorest parishes in the old days, you know, when the Spaniards owned it and the British was there, you know, during the days of slavery. It was considered one of the poorest parish. But now it's one of the fastest growing parish, of course, not only because of tourism, but, you know, a lot of things. And I want to just mention before I go into the details that a lot of things in music are held there. You know, there are sometimes jazz concerts, and I think they have something called Sunsplash that takes place once a year. So it becomes, you know, very popular during those periods in the music industry is what I mean, beside people just going there to vacate. So I'm hoping, Donna, that one of these days you'll be taking a visit to Montego Bay. Right? Are you there, Donna?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely look forward to, you know, getting a chance to do that, particularly since it's so popular.
Right. It's very popular. And a lot of people land there even if they're going to another part of the island.
Oh, okay.
So let me just start off by giving a little history. You know, I'm a person who the old information sort of intrigued me, and I always try to find a lesson from back in the days, long before, you know, even my existence, and things that I know about that can connect with something that we're experiencing now. And so far, almost every parish that I that we've visited, there's always something or someone, you know, that is important to that particular parish that we can relate to something or get a lesson about something in our lives now or something that is happening in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just give you a little history about the parish of Manchester. Now, actually, it was named, as many of them are, the parishes are usually named after someone, you know, from way back in the days. But anyway, it was named after, we're doing St. James, right? I'm getting
right.
A little sidetracked here because I want to tell my listeners that I'm broadcasting from a different venue today because I had a little family emergency and had to relocate from my house to somebody else's house. So I'm trying to scramble here. So do bear with me. And this is the only time that I'll pull out the senior button, really. You know that, Donna, because I don't really buy that. But let's start with St. James. Okay. So St. James was named not after a saint, because a lot of people might think because of St. James, it has something to do with religion. But it was not named after a saint. It was named after James, Duke of York, and was formed as a parish in 1664. It was much larger at the time since it included what are now the separate parishes of Trelawney and Hanover. And, you know, as I say that, you know, Donna, I know here in the United States, and especially here where we live in the South, you know, sometimes there's rezoning for political reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
They rezone certain areas if they want to make one area larger. But as I go back in history, I see that it was being done from back in the days because, you know, they took parts of other parishes. As a matter of fact, they took part of what was then Trelawney and Hanover to include in part of St. James. So the thing about St. James is that it has lots of remains of the original people of that area, you know, the original Arawak Indians. Mm-hmm. They have actually found some of the remains in that particular parish. So the history of the whole island goes way back, as I mentioned in some of the talks before, you know, like 600 B.C. So, you know, it's an old, old piece of land submerging from the sea, I suppose. But I know that along with a lot of other of our listeners, I feel so fortunate to have been born and raised in paradise. I did not consider it paradise at the time, but as I look back and I go into the history, you know, of all the people who perhaps inhabited the island before I did, it just gives me a special feeling. Anyway, all the north coast, all of that area in the north was supposedly heavily populated by these, you know, ancient people. As a matter of fact, they were called the Fairfield people after a site near to Montego Bay where some of the characteristics of their pottery had been found. So, you know, there have been archaeologists that have been researching in those areas and have come up with a lot of artifacts to really date the history of different parts of Jamaica and, you know, how it was inhabited and who inhabited it. But, and also I'd like to mention that, you know, different parts of the island have different types of soil. So the people who inhabited in the early days would make things, whether it's their religious ornaments or things they wear, from the soil. So they could tell, you know, the kinds of people and where they really lived, which I thought was very interesting. Now, the Spaniards also had a highway through St. James from into Westmoreland, and I can't think of a highway being constructed in those times, you know, in 17-whatever, because it was so such a rural place. But they mentioned a highway that the Spaniards had, that is even before the English took it over. But speaking of that, I just want to tell a personal story about Westmoreland, because that we're going to be doing that shortly. But that is the parish that most of my family was from. And I remember as a little girl, I always thought, I lived in Kingston, but I always, when I visited Westmoreland and its capital is Savalamar, I always was so intrigued by the how wide the streets were. You know, it was like I could not get over, especially a particular street that was called Great George Street. And we'll go into more of that when we do Westmoreland. But I just thought it was interesting that this particular documentation, which I'm quoting from the Encyclopedia of Jamaican Heritage by Olive Senior, and for people interested in history, it's just a wonderful publication, and I would suggest it has, you know, it has covered so much and has been so helpful. So I do want to give credit to that writer. Now, so my point is that they would mention that the Spaniards had a highway that connected St. James to Westmoreland, which they're like adjoining parishes. And I considered the streets in Savalamar as just being so awesome, you know, at the time when I was a child. So I don't know if that was part of anything that was left over from the Spanish, you know, when the Spanish occupied it. But I just thought it was interesting. Now, there are still many legends in the parish about treasure that is supposed to have been left by the Spanish colonists. That I never knew before. So it is believed that in St. James, there is treasure that has been undiscovered that the Spaniards hid. And it reminds me of, you know, a lot of these stories that are going on about, you know, finding treasures, you know, like the pirates stories. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if any of the Jamaicans that might be interested in that type of thing are doing any studies or any digging. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Okay. For many years after the English conquest, the north side of the island, including St. James, was sparsely settled. In 1673, only 146 persons resided in the entire parish. One year, the parish was so poor, its citizens were excused from paying taxes. And, of course, then the citizens, I suppose, were plantation owners, you know what I mean? The north coast was far from the seat of government in Spanish Town. At that time, it was Spanish Town that was the capital of the whole island. And the interior of the parish was inhabited by the Maroons. The roads were in shocking condition and communication was poor. From Montego Bay to Spanish Town would have been a 3 or 4 day coach journey undertaken in stages. They'd have to, like, I suppose, take their coach and rest at a point and then start again. So it'd take 3 or 4 days to get from Montego Bay to the capital. And only 146 people lived in the whole parish. Now, wait till you hear the population down later on down in the story. However, St. James was quickly developed by the sugar planters and grew to great wealth in the mid-18th century. By 1780, the capital of Montego Bay was registered next to Kingston as the most flourishing town in the island. In 1982, it officially became Jamaica's second city. With the decline of sugar, the parish's prosperity came from banana. So they switched from sugar to banana once the, I suppose, the sugar trade went down. The Montego Bay base and J.F. Kerr shipping the fruit of his own vessel, on his own vessel, and tourism began at the beginning of the 20th century and is now a major industry. So although tourism started there, you know, it really started after Portland. But because it was such a busy place with the banana and the sugar, I suppose, you know, it caught on. Now, in 1795, the parish was turned upside down by the Maroons in the interior who took up arms. And after that, after decades of peace, Montego Bay became the headquarters of the governor, the Earl of whoever, someplace in England that I can't pronounce, who came to personally direct operations against the slaves. And it was from here that the Trelawney Maroons were put aboard ships in the harbor that eventually sailed to Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. I never knew that.
Wow.
So actually, they put some of the Maroons on board a vessel and sent them off to Nova Scotia in Canada. That's
wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, Montego Bay also witnessed the final act of the last slave uprising, which was called the Christmas Rebellion. And that we're going to talk a little bit more about the national hero that was born in St. James, actually, Samuel Sharp. But I thought that was interesting about the Maroons because, as I said, I'm learning so much now about the, you know, what happened, transpired during those periods, that I am just like a kid in a, you know, in a candy store. I just want to welcome, the board is lighting up. There are several callers on from all over. We have callers from 631 and 716, and we have some people in the chat room, so I just want to welcome everybody and tell them that you're listening to the Backyard Labrish. We're here each Wednesday just trying to catch up on our history and finding things to celebrate about our beautiful island of Jamaica. And for people in the diaspora, you know, this can be very enlightening because a lot of us don't get to go back very often. And a lot of us might not know a lot about the history because I remember when I was in school, they're teaching more of the history of the island itself now since we have been, you know, independent than they did during the colonial years that I went to school. And then at that time, I was not as passionate about history as I am now. So I am not knocking the system because it could have been just me. And I'm always open to, if any of my callers that are online would like to interact with us and join the Labrish, please just hit 1 on your telephone. I'll see that you've raised your hands, and I'll open up the mic and welcome you to the Labrish because that's what a Labrish is all about, is for us to just have a chat. So today we're chatting about St. James, that was considered the poorest parish way back in the days, but now it's totally changed. So I wanted to just share. Donna, do you have any comments?
Well, yeah, you know, I was just, I did a little research, and it was kind of interesting because they were saying when the Spanish were occupying Jamaica, Montego Bay, pretty much what they did was exported lard. But it was kind of interesting that they said they obtained the lard from wild hogs.
Hogs, yes, because they were all over the island.
Oh,
and
wow.
Especially in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And the original name that the Spaniards gave it really meant lard, you know, the Spanish name that they gave it. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they used it, they exported it to Spain or wherever, other mm-hmm. parts of the world. But, you know, it's quite interesting because
yeah,
they were not doing sugar on bananas.
Yeah, that was really what I'm thinking, because it says that after the treaty with the Maroons in 1739, then they started doing the sugar production.
Right,
so that the Spaniards weren't able to do anything because of the Maroons there, and they didn't have a, you know, permission from them or whatever to, you know, maybe go further into the to the parish to or you know, wherever the sugar's being farmed at.
So they got rid of them fast. They put them on a ship and sent them to Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I think that was a little bit later, but it just goes to show that what Montego Bay and what, you know, St. James had in terms of the sugar production, because they said that it ended up developing a lot of wealthy people from that.
Oh, yes, definitely. Now I want to talk a little bit about the – thank you, Donna, for enlightening us about that. I want to talk a little bit about Mr. Samuel Sharp, and I thought this was so interesting because, you know, although he was a slave, he was educated. So I think a lot of the differences with perhaps how the people on – Jamaica, I don't know about other islands, but, you know, from what I'm reading, the people, some of the planters in Jamaica and perhaps here in the United States, is that some of the planters actually encouraged some particular slaves to be educated. I thought that was very interesting. And I see we have a raised hand at 718-379. So I'm going to open up the mic. Good evening. This is Backyard Labrish. Margaret speaking. Who am I speaking with?
You're speaking with Leigh, from the home of the Yankees.
Right. That would be the Bronx, right?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Leigh, from the Bronx, home of the Yankees. How are you today?
Good. Good. Thank you.
Well, welcome to the celebration of St. James.
All right.
Okay, so what would you like to share with us this evening?
Well, I just heard you mention Sam Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a wise guy in those days, around the year 1831.
Mm-hmm.
And wise guy in the sense of uprisings. He led some uprisings in Western Jamaica, which would be in the area you're talking about.
Right. But you know what I found very interestingly is that, number one, I read an article, you know, about him personally, and they talked about him being educated, you know, whoever owned him allowed him to become, you know, well-schooled. And he was actually a Baptist deacon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he did not, he was... and one article spoke about him that he would like be a forerunner of Martin Luther King or Gandhi, because he was really preaching about a peaceful rebellion.
Yes.
But of course, when you're trying to lead a group of people, everybody does not see the change the way you see it. You know what
right.
I mean? So my point is, you see how things from the past and people from the past, how they behave, can really relate to things that are happening now and that things we're aware of in our lifetime.
Right.
So I thought that was very interesting, because some articles don't talk about the fact that he was not really inciting violence.
No.
He was coming from a different platform.
Yes, well, you know, history is written by people, and they see it the way they want to sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, he was blamed for it, and he took the blame, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they eventually killed him. But he was a Christian, he was a Baptist deacon.
Yes.
And he suggested, you see, because I'm sure there was not as much communication then. Of course, they didn't have any, I suppose. But he actually thought that it was passed in England and just wanted the slaves to protest because they feel they should be paid. That was the whole his idea.
Well, round about the time when all this was happening, there was the different churches were being introduced in that area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't know if you saw in your research that the French Revolution happened almost around the same time as well, and a lot of refugees
mm-hmm.
from Europe, particularly in France, went to the Western world, Jamaica being one of the locations that some of these people came to.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the Baptist Church. The Baptist Church was founded a little earlier on, like in 1814, and in 1830, this William Knibb arrived in the area,
mm-hmm.
actually in Falmouth. So a lot of things were happening to promote religion in that time period.
Right, right.
And so Sam Sharp had a big following.
Right, right.
Oh, well, when you think about it, they killed, well, on one thing it said 300, another said 500 slaves were executed. So, I mean, that's a pretty big following.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, whenever you have a rebellion, that's what they call it, you know, you're going to have a lot of people getting hurt.
Yeah.
And several of those things happened in Jamaica because by this time, people, as you say, Madge, they were being educated by their mentors, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And once people in a lower station of life, like slaves and otherwise, they would, once they become educated, they're different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Definitely. But I just thought it was interesting that he, even during those days, they, I suppose the slave masters would select special people and have them educated, because he seemed to have been, and I suppose that is why he would have the respect of the other slaves, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to round them up. But of course, even although you might have the followers, you cannot really control their emotions or what they did, because they said that was not his idea. He didn't advocate a violent rebellion.
Right.
What he had envisioned was similar to what Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King had, you know, a passive resistance, a sit-down strike of all slaves of the Western parishes to force the plantation owners to pay them for their work and thus affirming their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
He and many others believed that the King of England had already given this freedom, free paper it was called, the plantation owners were withholding. That's what they believed. On each of the estates, a driver who was part of the plan was delegated to tell the overseer when they returned after the three-day Christmas holiday that the slaves would work no more without wages. That was the plan. But militant elements took over, and on the last night of the holidays, set fire to the first estate, which is the Kensington estate that was located in St. James. So that's where it actually started. By midnight, 16 other estates in the West were burning, and rebellion was underway, led by some of Sharp's most trusted lieutenants. The rebels easily got people to volunteer, and they roamed over the countryside, gathering force and destroying estates. Though there was no central plan, you see, they were not organized because that was not the plan. But the terrified planters and their family fled, leaving for a while 50,000 slaves suddenly free and uncertain what to do. You see what happened? Chaos really broke out.
Trouble in the camp.
Right. Sharp himself moved among the estates, counseling and praying, though there was little he could do to control the situation. The rebellion engulfed the West and created panic and fear in the rest of the island, and was not subdued until early January by superior military force. Now, then the reprisal against the slaves began. For 6 weeks, trials were held under martial law at Montego Bay Courthouse, and day after day, the magistrate handed out sentences of guilty. The slaves were led out and hanged in twos at the gallows on the parade, which is now Samuel Sharp Square. They were left hanging until another lot were brought out to be hanged. Then they were cut down and thrown into mass graves. I wonder if there's any markation of these graves still existing. Anyway, it is estimated that 312 slaves were executed and over 1,000 killed by soldiers. You know, it's the execution and killed is two different things. While 16 white colonists were killed. But most historians now agree that if it did nothing else, the rebellion forced the authorities to speed up the process of freeing the slaves. Full freedom coming in 1838. Samuel Sharp gave himself up. He gave himself up to the authorities. But even in jail, he never lost his composure, praying and preaching to his fellow prisoners. On the 23rd of May, 1832, Sharp was hanged, the last of the executions. They left him for the last, you know, I wanted to kill everybody before him. He had admitted responsibility and cleared of any blame the white missionaries because, you know, he was part of the church, who were themselves in great danger, having been accused of fomenting the rebellion, which was called the Baptist War. From the number of members of the churches who were involved, you know, because there were so many church people involved in the whole thing, they gave it a religious name, the Baptist War. Mm-hmm. Ain't that something? Mm-hmm. He was called Daddy Sharp, and he was held in high esteem. That he was hanged and buried in a suit made and sent to him by the women of the family that owned him. And his owner also tried in vain to obtain his body for a decent burial. Instead, he was ordered burial in the sands near the harbor. But Sharp was loved and respected even in defeat. For many years afterward, his grave was opened and his bones taken out by three church members and reverently buried in the vault at the old church, Memorial Church, where he was a deacon. These were the colonists that were doing that, not the slaves.
Yeah.
So my point is that even in the worst of times, you know, there are always people who want to do right. You know, there are a lot of, most times they're outnumbered. But I find it, you know, that it's not everybody that is always, you know, in any times, whether it's during the Roman times, you know, there were people who were Romans who were compassionate about the Christians and tried their best to do what they could. So we can really relate that to know that I'm sure that, you know, in the countries that we're at war with, you know, I'm sure that there are several people there that don't think like the bad people. but they're almost like trapped. Because you figure that, you know, just like we in the United States or in any other country who might not agree with a war, you might not agree, you might be totally against it, but you have to adhere to whatever is going on if you are sent to fight. Mm-hmm. You know what? So we can really relate that a lot of things that are happening now has been happening over history. But people that really have good intentions have always survived. So I thought that was very interesting that, you know, he was given so much respect even by the other side. Because for his owners, the people who owned him, to want to, you know, have him have a reverent burial, you know that they must have loved it.
Well, you know, also, the bottom line is that he's not the person that caused everything to happen. He was trying to do it through passive resistance. And so those people around him knew who he was and knew that he wasn't responsible for what had transpired, how it got out of hand. But yet and still, I guess, you know, through whatever trial or whatever, they, you know, determined him to be guilty and all. But so I would think that that's a big part of it. You know, that's just generally how it would be. You know, people that are closest to you know you and say, you know, this is not right, or, you know, want to take care of, you know, his remains and things like that. But
right.
one of the things I thought was pretty interesting about this is the whole, you know, the thing with the slaves was that they did something called apprenticeship period, where they really was supposed to be like a transition from slavery to give them freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that it really didn't work out, you know, as planned, that there were a lot of, you know, misuse. They weren't fed. There were brutal punishments. I was reading one of them that was really something. This guy, Lord Sligo. Uh-oh. She lost me. Hello?
I'm here. You're here. You're on.
Okay. Lord Sligo.
You went off for a minute.
Okay. What happened was he didn't like for slaves to be whipped, particularly women. So he brought this contraption called a treadmill, and it's not like our treadmill. It's a large cylinder with a series of steps attached to it, and the person's weight, I mean, they probably look like a gerber or a hamster, you know, and their weight would cause the cylinder to spin, and they would have to, like, kind of run quickly to remain standing. And if they fail or fainted, they were hung by their wrists, and the steps would hit them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy, and they said that the conditions really got worse. And what happened? One of the organizations that got involved in it were the Quakers, and I thought that was pretty interesting because the Quakers were very involved in, you know, the abolition of slavery, you know, here in the United States. So it was kind of interesting that they even, you know, wrote books about it, and to incite the, you know, the British public on it. And so, but at any rate, you know, that was a part of, you know, moving towards, you know, full emancipation. But the sad part to me is the same thing that happened with slavery here. You move from being a slave to, you know, even though it was supposed to be an apprenticeship, it wasn't. They were still working almost like slaves, where they would have, you know, a room and board and things like that. But there really was no transition for those people that couldn't read or didn't have skills outside of plantation work. You know, you got freedom, but what else do you have? You know, you don't have a home. You may not have a home. You may not have. There's a lot of things that, you know, that the person, you know, would not have, and all. And so it really wasn't, you know, complete. They really weren't completely free.
But
right.
But Donna, a lot of these slaves were given parcels of land. To
right. I was just about to say that. It's a little different
from
it happened here. Because not only that, I'm going to do another segment, I think, because a lot of them were allowed to not only grow, you know, food provision on the land that they got, but they were allowed to sell it. They would go to the marketplace. That's how a lot of, I'm going to do something on the how the origination of the markets, because the markets in Jamaica was a big thing from way back. And I remember as a child, we had so, for a small island, we had a lot of foot markets. Like, you remember Coronation Market, Chigapook Market, this kind of market, that kind of market.
Yeah, but even in the area we're talking about, there is a huge market down in
St. James?
Montego Bay, yes.
Right. So.
I can remember my father and I, the last trip to vacation to Montego Bay, I was silly enough to get on a bus with him and go down Main Street just to get to the market.
See the market, yes.
But the problem was, like maybe 2 or 3 years prior, the market was burned down.
Mm.
That huge market we're talking about.
Right.
And then, this is in Falmouth now, whenever I go, I like to go to the market there.
Oh, I love the market. love the market.
And most of these areas in the square, so-called square, where you have this clock and so forth, you always have a market.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where people would bring, as you were saying, their produce,
right,
or whatever.
Extra. And I'm going to do a segment just on the markets, how the markets originated. But I just wanted to finish up about Samuel Sharp. They say, mention here, although Jamaica was the most rebellious of the New World slave colonies, what made this particular rebellion remarkable is that it was entirely the work of Creole slaves. That is, those born in the island and who were presumably socialized into European values. So the most of the people who participated in that Baptist rebellion were not brought in as slaves. They were born on the island into slavery, and they called them Creole slaves. Did you know that was the name that they gave them, Lay?
Well, my interpretation of Creole was slightly different from
right.
Baptist.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I was totally, when I saw it here, Creole, slaves is what, and she mentions, as I said, this is an encyclopedia I'm reading from, and
yeah,
it mentioned that is those born in the island and who were presumably socialized into European values.
Yeah, well, you know, the word probably evolved into something different in our time, so to speak.
Right.
But, I follow you.
Earlier revolts, she mentioned here, had involved mainly the Africans born in the community. So anyway, Sharp was a literate man who read the newspaper of the day, and his sense of urgency was fueled by his belief that freedom had been granted but was being withheld by the planters. Contributing to this fear was the violent language used by the planters who were supposed to emancipation, who was opposed to emancipation, and the threats by some to hand the island over to the Americans. Listen to this. They were threatening the slaves that they would hand it over to the Americans if the Emancipation Act went through. Since slavery still existed in the United States, that would have left no hope for speedy emancipation. But it was funny how they would use that as a threat. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, you better behave yourselves, or we're going to send you over to America.
Sounds like a stretch anyway, I mean, you know.
Right. Well, I must say that I have not been really involved in researching a lot of the history of the slavery here. But from the little I know, it seems that there were not a lot of slave owners that were as generous in many ways to their slaves as it seemed to have been on our island, because there are several stories of, you know, some of the slaves getting special privileges and in this case, and in several cases of them being educated. And I mean, he was educated to the point where he could read fluently. You know, he would read the newspapers from cover to cover, and he could comprehend, you know, legal issues and things like that. So I found that very interesting. So now I want to read you a little bit. Donna, did you have a comment?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Okay. So I wanted to tell you now a little bit about some of the places of interest in St. James. And I want to welcome all our listeners. We have the board is full. And if you do want to join the language and you have some tips about anything about St. James, we're not just talking about the way back in the days. We're just intrigued with history, so we're going to fast forward in a minute. But I find that, you know, there's a quote that says, you know, knowing our past really help us with our now and our future. So I just find a lot of interest. I'm very interested in all of these nuggets of information that I have been stumbling on as I try to do my island tour. So the St. James Parish Church is a little famous because it's an Anglican church in St. James. And it was dedicated. Now that I'm doing that because, you know, St. James, the parish, was named after some political person of the times. But the church itself now was named after a saint, St. James the Great, the patron saint of Spain. Lay, you were familiar that St. James was a Spanish saint?
No.
Oh, well, now you know. I wasn't.
No.
I figured that because it's it's not necessarily a Catholic. It's an Anglican saint. They have saints too?
Oh yes. Really? Don't forget the Anglican Church was the Catholic Church initially.
Ooh. Oh yeah, I forgot. But anyway, it says here the Anglican Church in St. James was named after this patron saint of Spain.
Man.
It was built between 1775 and 1782, and was regarded by the visiting artist Harkwell as the finest church in Jamaica. In 1957, the building was wrecked by an earthquake. 1957? We had an earthquake in
57? Yeah, lots of earthquakes that we don't even remember about.
But this says, in 1957, the building was wrecked by an earthquake, but was restored with few changes from the original. The structure is in the form of a Greek cross with a bell tower at the western end. I can't remember seeing the church because, of course, I must tell my listeners and you, Donna, that when I lived in Jamaica, I never went to Montego Bay, although I visited Westmoreland for many, many times over my whole lifetime there. But as close as Montego Bay was to Sablemar, I never visited. I went to Negril, but not Montego Bay. And foreigners believe that if you're from Jamaica, of course, you know everywhere, and you know the whole island, and you've been to all the parishes. But my first visit to Montego Bay was after I'd migrated here into the States, and my plane happened to land in Montego Bay on a stopover before it went to Kingston. And that was my very first visit to Montego Bay. So, you know, it's a small island, but when you, growing up in the 40s and 50s, I'm sorry, 30s and 40s, like I did, you know, the travel was, it was not the same as it is now.
Well, now, if you're in a car, about how long would it take for you to travel from one end of Jamaica to the other?
Oh, now it takes much less time than
you're
it
talking
did.
Talking about now or before?
Now.
Oh.
Now.
Perhaps.
Now it's about cut in half since they have these highways.
Right.
And you could probably get from Kingston to Montego Bay in 2 hours. Two and a half hours. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
wow.
in the times, the earlier times before the highways, it is like a half a day.
Mm.
You know, with those winding hills and mountains.
Yeah, and the precipice. Okay, well, we're not talking about that today. Let me just tell you a little bit more history about the first church in Montego Bay. Listen to this. The earliest baptism recorded in this church was in 1771. And the earliest marriages and the earliest burials were in 1774. Now, inside the church are some interesting monuments, including two marble monuments by the famous English sculptor, John Beacon. Were you aware of that, Leg?
Not.
He's a very famous English sculptor.
Yes, Beacon I know about. But
did you know that there's a sculpture in this particular church?
No, I didn't know. Because
neither did I. I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with all of this information, but I was very intrigued with that.
Yes, that, you know, that's... historical church, and I know the Catholic Church, but I don't know the Anglican Church.
Right. But listen to the interesting part of this that is going to lead us into what we're going to talk about less, which is the spooky stuff. But one of the monuments, which is left of the altar, is to Mrs. Rosa Palmer, and it was erected by her husband. Now, it was for a long time mistakenly believed to be the monument to the White Witch of Rose Hall, but then it's not, really. And that leads me to this spooky stuff. Do you know that there are people who visit Jamaica for the sole reason of going to the Great House that is supposedly haunted? And I'm talking like Ghostbusters. Were you familiar with that, Leigh? As a matter of fact,
yes.
There was an article that there was some renowned one who, I don't know what do you call them, but it's the people who have the instruments to record, you know, this kind of movement if there's ghosts in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had two different ones who went there to do their thing. But now that I'm doing a lot of research on that, it is believed that none of that really happened, you know, and it all came about by the story that has been passed down. But anyway, let me give you a little information about Rose Hall Great House. It's now a great tourist attraction, of course, because it offers visitors a tour of the beautifully restored Great House. And as well as contact with Jamaica's most powerful legend of the White Witch of Rose Hall. Now, it is not, it's near Montego Bay, but not really in Montego Bay. And the Great House itself was regarded as the most magnificent planter's residence ever built in Jamaica. Now, the house fell into ruins in the early 20th century, and in 1960, it was faithfully restored with authentic period furnishings under the supervision of somebody out there who did much of the work in historic restoration in Jamaica. It is part of a development that was undertaken by John Rawlings, a former lieutenant governor of Delaware, here in the United States.
I met his wife. I won't tell you the circumstances, but...
But I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, that it's a governor from here who was interesting. And you know, it might have something
well,
to do with his ancestors.
This Mr. Rawlings was a wheeler and dealer and exercised very big influence in that area.
Mm.
I'm talking about wheeling and dealing, buying and selling, owning all kinds of lands, and unbelievable stuff. And yet he was a representative in the House of, as you said, in this country.
Right. He was an American.
So you see, even then, this stuff was going on.
Oh, yes.
With the American
Wheelers and Dealers.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the Great House was built between 1770 and 1780 by the Honorable John Palmer, who was Custos of St. James then, whose wife was Rosa Palmer, to all accounts a lovable and gracious lady. Her beautiful marble tomb can be seen in the St. James Parish Church. She's not buried on the thing. She's buried at church.
Now,
for a long time, it was believed she was the legendary White Witch of Rose Hall.
Just a little tidbit before you go any further. Do you know, Madge, that the Palmers were the next-door resident to neighbors to the Nunises?
You mean in Westmoreland where we were born, where we came from?
St. James. No,
yeah,
not
St.
Westmoreland.
St. James.
That's a whole other story, but I just thought I'd interject that.
Oh, my
goodness. Mrs. Palmer, I know.
Okay. Now, only recently has Rosa Palmer's name and reputation been cleared, and Annie Palmer designated as the Wicked Witch. So, you know, they were getting their Palmers confused at one period of the story. Now, while Rosa and John Palmer were alive, the magnificent Rose Hall was the setting for the most elaborate balls and assemblies on that side of the island. After the death of the couple, Rose Hall was neglected for many years until it was inherited by John Palmer's grandparents. Now, John Rose Palmer, that was who in John and the grand people, the grand nephews were John and Rose Palmer. Now, in 1820, John Rose, that Rose is a man's name? John Rose Palmer married. His marriage certificate to Anne Palmer, now there's the Wicked Witch, is in Jamaica's archives. Ain't that something? Since the record of his burial had also been found in the St. James Parish Register, his disappearance, which is part of the story, you know, at the hands of his wife, as the legends say, is unlikely. So they're finding out things now because of the archives that does not collaborate the story. Because, you know, in the story, she supposedly, he disappeared. Right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a tall tale story that we knew from childhood days,
right,
and it was
right.
Very intriguing, the whole story about her and her husbands and
her lovers
and our lovers and the pouring of the oil in their ears and all of this good
stuff. She supposedly had gotten some voodoo lessons from some of the slaves, you know. But according to the legend, the woman who became mistress of Rose Hall was Anne May Patterson, who was born of an English mother and an Irish father and grew up in Haiti, where it is said she was schooled in voodoo. Though Annie Palmer had been identified as the White Witch, it is possible that in time her name, like Rosa Palmer's, will be cleared, since no one so far has managed to unravel facts from fiction. So isn't that ironic?
Yeah, I was looking at when I saw what you were going to talk about. I went into the White Witch of Rose Hall, and it gave some information about her. And it pretty much one of the things that was kind of interesting. It said that that in the 1700, a woman's route to wealth and power was usually through marriage.
Marriage, of course.
So she was no exception. They said she was born in France, and she was barely 4 feet tall. And she moved to Jamaica, went to marry the powerful guy who owns this thousands of acres sugar plantation. And but they said that they wondered what happened, because she had this streak of cruelty, and they weren't sure if it was because of the demands of her husband or, you know, exactly what happened. But one of the things that she hated, she really hated Jamaica because she missed the bright life of Paris. Mm-hmm. And so she found the life there to be a hardship. But whatever, you know, the cause of it, they said that she would come out on, there was a balcony, and she would come out on the balcony, and she would issue the orders to the slaves that would be waiting out in the yard. And her orders start, you know, were anything from what was to, you know, happen in terms of plantation, but also included executions and punishments, and she would bellow out these orders, and they don't know if it was from boredom or what, but she started to take slaves to her bed. But what happened was, when she got tired of them, she murdered them. Mm-hmm. And so she was getting, and she would bury them in unmarked graves, and they don't know if she got, you know, bored of her husband, or if he caught her with one of the slaves, but they said that she murdered him in the bed as well. And they were saying that that the slaves had, you know, she had learned this black magic, this voodoo, because they said it was really hard for a woman to be by herself on such a large plantation with pirates and things like that. But what they came, what got out was that she had all these magical powers, and that she knew voodoo, and so you know, pretty much steered clear of her. Plus, she did, you know, marry two other husbands that she killed, that she also killed. And but they said that what really was the straw was that her overseer, who was a slave, was also a voodoo practitioner, and his daughter was supposed to marry this young guy, but Annie decided that she had an eye for him, and normally what she would do is she would play with them, you know, keep them for a couple of weeks, and then she'd kill them. So the overseer started saying, okay, I got to figure out what I'm going to do to save this young man, but they don't know if the boy said, you know, I'm in love with the other girl or what, because she killed him that night. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, they said that he decided he was going to go ahead and kill her.
Hello?
And that they supposedly, he prepared a special grave for her and all this stuff.
Hi, Terry, how are you?
And there was a whole ritual that's supposed to take place when they buried her, but that the overseer was killed, as he sacrificed his own life as a part of it. But so the other slaves on the plantation had to, you know, go ahead and bury her, but they didn't complete the ritual properly, they say, and so that's the reason why they say that she's still haunting the place.
Right. But what I found interesting, Donna, is that there has been, you know, these psychics, or these people that are supposedly able to see the people from the other world, and they claim, and people take pictures, and, you know, but there's all sorts of reflection from glass and things like that that can appear in a photograph. But it's interesting, because it's only now that there's research being done into some of these stories, and Olive, who is the author of this encyclopedia, mentioned that in the legend, the first husband supposedly disappeared. You know, she did away with him, and they didn't know what happened. But they found that in the records, there's a record of his death. So I don't know if because he disappeared, they still registered him as dead afterward. It doesn't say that, you know. But because, you know, even now, if a person is missing for a certain length of time, then for their family, in order to get insurance or whatever, to settle, to have some closure, they can declare them dead after a certain period of time. I'm sure you're familiar with that, right, Donna?
Yeah, well, it was saying that during this time that there were pirates, it was a complete time of lawlessness.
Oh,
and,
yes. And that, you know, we were that, wicked in a lot of ways, not just with the slavery, but also in piracy and things like that.
But they said that some odd reason, you know, because they said that there was the death of the master of the estate, but because of the lawlessness and all things that were going on, there was no investigation that was done as to his cause of death.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure even though in those days, like it is now, sometimes you can have payoff for certain things, you know, and it depends on, I suppose, how rich you are even then.
Yeah. Hey, and also you got to think about it. If she was into the voodoo stuff,
right.
I mean, he could have been laying in the bed and she could have gave him something or, you know, made him, you never know. He couldn't talk or something. You know how they said that you could, people would blow powder on folks and they would
right.
like eat or whatever?
They're doing some, you know, there's been some research, and that is another show, but there's been some research on the zombies, I think they're called, in Haiti,
yeah.
And there are people walking around there. There are physical people that, like, they're in La La Land, and they found out that there's some way through some herbs and something, powders and all that, that people can actually be buried and then, you know, come up and walk around, but they're not here. But actually, there's been some research being done as we speak about all of that. But I thought it was very interesting because one of the things that I've learned from doing all of this research, and as I mentioned before, that there are so many things that happened, you know, way in the past before our times that we can relate to the now. But one of the most important things for me, and I want to encourage all our listeners, especially those that might have, you know, young children, which there's their children or their grandchildren, that we can leave from this generation is that regardless of the hardships and regardless of what's happening during the period that you're having your issues, you know, there other people before you went through the same thing, if not worse, much worse. Now, all of them didn't survive, but many of them did. And we can learn quite a few lessons about endurance, about tolerance, about unity, about so many things, just about understanding each other as human beings. You know, if we just really think about it, because even the way that Jamaicans from way back used to travel, and they're still traveling, but, I mean, travel is so much easier now. You know, you're jetting from one place to the next. Even on the island, you know, when I was growing up there, as Leigh said, it would take a half a day to get from one place to another because the roads were not that, you know, good, and it took a long time. Perhaps the cars didn't even go as fast.
Worse if you had a little rainfall the day before.
Right. We had a place, I remember, where if you were on your way to a certain part of the island, you'd have to worry if you could get over that river, a bridge. What was the name of that bridge? I don't remember.
Flat Bridge.
But we're almost out of time. I see that we have had a lot of listeners tonight. I want to welcome you and thank you for spending some time with us in the backyard. We hope you really enjoy the Labrish as much as we do, and we hope you'll join us next week for another interesting parish. It may be one of yours.
Do you know which parish is going to be next?
It's
week?
On the website. I don't remember. We only have a few left. We only have four. I know that St. Elizabeth is the last one. We have Westmoreland and another parish.
You have not done Trelawney?
Trelawney, Westmoreland, and another one. But, you know, I'm a senior, so you know, I have to do it one week at a time, Leigh. Nobody's helping me. So we have 10 seconds left. I want to say thanks for all my listeners for joining me. And do go to Backyard Labrish and leave us a comment. It's www.backyardlabrish.com. So give us a visit. Give us your comments. And do raise your hand so we can interact with you. So thank you. Thanks a lot for joining us. And we hope to see you next week. So my co-host and my loyal listener from the Bronx, home of the Yankees, would you say goodnight to our listeners, please?
Goodnight all.
All right, and we hope to see you next week. Make it a great week. And if you're from Jamaica, stand proud and tall. And if you love Jamaica, learn more about our fantastic island and our fantastic history. So join us next week in the backyard. See you all. Bye-bye. Nice talking to you. Good night.